The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, Episode 4. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. That noise you are hearing now is the live guitar playing of Mr. Gareth Mitchell. Gareth started in Bristol and then London, playing in so-called post-rock bands, which means first in Secret Garden, later in one of the many incarnations of the band Amp. In 1996, he started putting out solo records, the first two being under the moniker Philosopher's Stone, and then several under his own name. Toward the end of this episode, we're going to be considering one of his vocal and guitar pieces from his 2012 album Spectre, but most of our time today is going to be spent on his soon-to-be-released album 72, which is an instrumental electronic music album. Now, if that description makes you want to stop this episode right now, just hold your horses, because this is not a matter of turning on a drum machine and cranking out club beats. Gareth is an academic, and as you'll hear, every little detail of what he does is thought to death. Every sound he uses, he either created himself or modified significantly, or at least has something to say about. As you'll see, he is a granular composer. He creates little bits of things and puts them together in interesting ways. Given my own rock and roll background in songwriting, this was a stretch for me. I kind of overprepared. You'll see in a few places, I even used the song exploder trick of replaying that 5 seconds of music that we're talking about in the discussion, just so you don't get lost. So despite my discomfort on having to dive into an instrumental thing like this that uses a composition style that's pretty foreign to my own, I ended up getting a lot out of it and hope you do too. You can get more information on Gareth at garethmitchell.info, and you can get more information on this podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Okay, I'm here with Gareth Mitchell. Thanks for doing this. Welcome.
My pleasure.
The first two songs we're going to talk about here are from your new album, 72. You said that was about your dad?
Yeah, this is a very unusual project, really. Firstly, because when I started it, I didn't really realize I'd started it. And by that, I mean I was, as you can imagine, in a sort of grieving process. And after I spent a lot of time with friends and family after my father died, I eventually found myself alone and did what I often do when I'm feeling creative, which was just to play around with sound or write on the guitar or sing. And I sort of noticed, really, that a lot of the things I was making were quite interesting and were really touched with a particular kind of energy, which in retrospect is not surprising, having just been through this extraordinary event. And so I thought eventually the best thing to do would be to sort of honour the material, really, that already existed and persevere with it and push it into a form that was coherent in some way and follow the kind of innate potential that existed in these seeds of ideas. I mean, it took me about 3 years to finish it, but I was always sort of adhering to these initial impulses and initial scraps of recording in some cases. So there were a few pieces that were really mapped out linearly quite quickly, and others which were really developed in a very incremental fashion and were sort of pieced together.
In which category does Circle, our first song, fall into?
That one's probably a bit of both of those. I mean, on the one hand, it was I kind of ran with it for, I suppose, about 2.5 minutes, and then it kind of ran out of steam, and I couldn't really understand where this piece really wanted to take me. And it took a very long time to pick up the reins, so to speak, or to re-examine it and step back and try and understand what the initial impulses were that led me towards making it in the first place, which was actually symptomatic of every track on the album, really, trying to understand what the emotional resonance was for me, what this feeling that I conjured, where that came from and what it really wanted to be if I focused on it and sort of drew out the various nuances from it. So yeah, Circle has this sort of initial demonstrative aspect, and then beyond that it's a question of sort of teasing out what these different strands would really like to be and developing the various details there to a point where they seem reflective of this state that I was trying to conjure.
And to give folks an idea of the structure, I mean, it sounds like it's a sequence piece, except for maybe the intro and the outro, some of the guitars, but then some of the sequences themselves, I understand that it's not unusual for you to sample things from your own guitar. So a couple of the melodies sound like they are pieces of recorded guitar notes put together. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I make a lot of work like that, and I've been doing that for a long time now. Mm. electric guitar in particular is really fascinating when you look at it in an almost molecular fashion, when you get down to a granular level, if you like, and start stretching it and repitching it and recontextualizing it as well, of course. Sometimes you'll play a flurry of notes, which if you just hear once may appear insignificant or may achieve only a particular effect, but you put them up against something else and the juxtaposition suddenly gives you a completely different impression. So yeah, I do a lot of that. So some of the passages may appear to be sort of played fairly fluidly and perhaps might not have been. And on the other hand, there are passages that may appear quite studied and pedantic that may be done quite quickly. There's a kind of confusion and ambiguity that I quite like playing with sometimes.
So it's creating these individual loops and then just bringing them back in different parts and making variations off of them.
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, the part of the process that I enjoy in some forms of composition relates to achieving what I might call a semi-hypnotic effect. In other words, you're playing with a loop, but then you're kind of breaking it.
Yeah.
I don't like things that just purely repeat, but I do like things that perhaps, if you were to think about them, you might think, well, what's going on here? Maybe I'm listening to a loop. But one of the things that's very time-consuming in my work is setting up all these different components so that they can spin and run on for as long as I see fit. But at the same time, they are malleable at any point, pretty much, that I want to adjust. So, yeah, I mean, of course, even the title of that piece suggests something circular, something that's spinning and rotating and looping. But there is, of course, even in pure repetition, there is change, simply because one is experiencing something over time and one's impression of something after one iteration is profoundly different to the experience after, say, 20. Even if it's just frustration or irritation, I think the subjective impression alters all the time. But if you add to that this ability to sometimes very subtly and gradually adjust what one's listening to, but as I'm leading a listener into slightly different avenues to the one they may have imagined they were initially embarking down.
So I had a hard time just in that most of my songwriting is vocal, and that's what structures, you know, it's verse, chorus, that kind of thing. You have a completely different approach, at least in this album. Even classical music basically has, they don't call it verse, chorus, but if you listen to Vivaldi's Four Seasons or something like that, there's the A section and there's the B section, and then they're noodling around. Like, you can pick it out. But as you were describing it, your structure here is much more granular, is much more, here is this one little part, and it's going to come in. They're mostly four measure sections. It seems to be what, you know, here we introduce something, it plays for four measures. At the end of four measures, maybe something else comes on top of it, or maybe the first thing distorts, goes away. Like, there's always something new happening generally in the four measure range. Is that just sort of, that's what's natural?
I think for that album, your maths is good there. I think that's what I was doing. I think part of that was simply because a lot of the music I just happened to be listening to before I started making it had that regularity. Although it ended up being a very particular album in terms of the point at which I decided it was finished, its initiation was anything but. So I had a set of parameters to work with that I hadn't previously formulated. They were there. So it's not conceptual in that sense. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it doesn't sort of adhere to this sonata form, for example. Although it does sort of hark back to this idea of, like Leibniz called it, the fold. This idea that you take a section and then you repeat it and then you alter one small thing. And of course, there's loads of Baroque music that follows that sort of idea. So in a sense, it's similar, except that the repetitions may not be repetitions of a melody or a section of melody. They may be something beat-oriented, for example.
Well, just the use of a dance beat of some sort at all seems like this is fairly new in when I was listening back in your older albums, and we have less obvious structure, much more of the guitar atmospherics and other created noise atmospherics that we hear a little bit in this song in the intro and outro. Can you say something about where this, okay, I'm going to actually have, if not an actual drum machine, although that is in places and it'll be more so in the second song we're going to listen to, but something that it has an immediate hook in that way. It's less immediately avant-garde. You can still have all this sound experimentation and tonal experimentation, but the fact that it has a beat means right there, people can chill out to it in that way.
Yeah, that does come through, I think. This idea to use drum machines and beats, it wasn't a pre-formulated idea. It's something that I've been using and I've been teaching music for a long time, and it's something I've taught a lot of people how to use. And as much as anything, I just thought it would be interesting to actually do something serious, and by serious I mean committed and finished, using drum machines. And I've been really dogmatically against it in my own work. Prior to making that record, I always thought it was an easy way of generating beats, even just on a sound level. I mean, I've used all kinds of different sounds, lots of guitar sounds that would stand for percussion. So I thought I would actually explore the characteristics of normal drum beats. There was one track, actually, the New York 1982 one, where I'd actually deliberately wanted to do something which did register and reflect a kind of impression of that period. As I started using this technique, I mean, there were sort of various characteristics in it that I thought were worth investigating. So I'm quite like changing a typical drum sound or using various effects on it in a way that's not typically used, or even moving a bass drum from left to right, which is more or less forbidden in dance.
Sure.
You're supposed to have it, you know, straight down the middle all the time. So within that quite sort of conservative attitude towards demarcating time, there is also an attitude of experimentation, I think.
Yeah, you've got this auto pan bass that comes in the middle, where that's it's left, right, left, right, left, right. And that's the pattern, is it's playing around with the pan in that way. I mean, I know since you create some of your samples from the guitar from nothing, it didn't sound like you were doing that with the drums, that you were more, these are the drum sounds that came with what I had, and maybe I'm adding some panning or more reverb or something, but you weren't messing with those samples. Is that accurate? Or?
You're absolutely right. I asked myself really why I did that, or more, not so much that I did it, that I allowed it to stay.
Because you could always keep working on it and sub out.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And that's a very strong part of my work. I have pieces I've been working on for years, literally. And not that I work on them every day, but, you know, I'll come back to them at various points and reconfigure them, reorientate them, whatever. Swap out various pieces, as you say. But I think there came a point where I realized that there was a coherence to the material as a whole that came about by leaving those beats there. And they became something that was perhaps anchoring, something that was constant, beyond all this other sort of experimentation. I still don't entirely understand why I felt comfortable using those, to be honest. I think there's still something I'm thinking about.
Well, it seems to fit. So one of the things that comes in early in here is this sort of auto arpeggio that reminded me of The Who.
Pete Townsend.
Yeah. Although the way it starts, I mean, most of it, you can listen to it and count it. I mean, it's like it's in four, but it starts with a three count. So it's sort of.
Hey, you're listening very carefully.
Well, I'm trying to go through these things and figure out what am I going to say about instrumentals. So to get a handle on this and remember what I'm hearing, you know, I'm going through and I'm writing down the structure. And I really found this auto arpeggio interesting because it's not totally linear. It's not just an arpeggio. It doesn't just go up and down and up and down. Even pitch wise, it starts in the middle and goes up and then it starts back at the bottom. And sometimes it's a four count, sometimes it's only a two count. It kind of throws you off on purpose. And especially the way it starts, where it seemingly gives the first measure of that section just over to the shimmery mood mist guitar that is bringing us into this section.
Yes, well, this is it. I mean, you've hit upon one of the enjoyable aspects, I think, of working in this manner. I mean, it's that you can set a loop running and then work in a sort of Russian doll type way, I suppose. I mean, you can gradually expand or double the length of something and then sort of vary the second part or make something an eighth as long and then double that and make a variation in that and then add that to the initial part. And you end up with just these sort of endless variations on what you started with. You can become very immersive, and because one of the really enjoyable characteristics of using sequences is that they are completely automatic. You can leave them running and you can just make a very small physical gesture to change just one parameter and leave it running. So it actually becomes more of a listening exercise. That's the sort of degree of participation that is most important. You're listening and then deciding how long something can sustain in order to not just hold, but increase interest. Because obviously the longer something goes on without changing, the more the tension increases. So then you say, well, how long can this go on for? So it becomes a very intuitive exercise. And then do I make a change here? If I do, what does that do? Does it actually create more interest because I change it? Or does it actually decrease tension? Does it actually become too intrusive? So one of those things, obviously, that you can change is time signature. And this is also, I think, interesting and kind of confounding expectation, because if you start using an arpeggiated sequence, particularly with a drum beat that comes in, then there are certain expectations because the medium is so established and the expectations are so set, because so much material is so similar in the way it is structured. I mean, it's very unusual to hear material of that nature deviating from four to the floor. So to sort of confound that expectation is not that difficult. I mean, obviously, if someone's just listening in a very cursory fashion, they're not going to notice any differences anyway. But I think, you know, any sort of degree of active listening is going to reveal the fact that something's going on that really is within the context of something, of a beat that's running at 4-4. It's actually very unusual. I mean, obviously, in the wider of music, it's in no way unusual whatsoever.
Well, and I was hearing a few elements in here that carried over from your earlier work, from your 90s work, from the first couple albums, Apparatus and Preparation, which when I was listening to those, that's where it's a lot more experimenting with sound, mood pieces. At times, the sound, you know, there was one track in particular, I think it was Filament, that it just has this like ripping noise that I was listening with my daughter in the car, and she's just like, make that stop. Yeah, like it was just a physically painful.
Yeah.
So we got a couple things like that in here. One is this crescendoing high harmonic that just is like feedback coming from your microphone when you point it at the amp, but it's done obviously in a controlled manner, put in the sequence here. And then the other thing that I noticed like that was another auto pan thing. Is this one of the drum sounds that you picked? Is this sort of little popping percussion sound that when the auto pan bass stops or on top of it, you've got this little in your left ear than your right ear. Where would that sound come from? Because that's not in your normal drum kit setup, seemingly.
I think actually it did come from a drum sound, but I've spent an extraordinary amount of time going through sounds and changing them in different ways. And of course, with modern software, I mean, the potential to do that very, very quickly constitutes a massive advantage. And that little sound is interesting. You should pick up on that, because I remember spending a long time trying to choose exactly which tiny sound I should use. and also the level in the mix that they should exist at. They almost become like a meta commentary, because again, you don't normally have sounds like that mixed so high up in the mix. You know, if you have something high up in the mix at all, then it's obviously a vocal in today's culture, or if you're in a club, it's a bass drum. Everything is typically very, very compressed, meaning that every instrument is pretty much at the same level, or certainly doesn't deviate from its initial position. Actually, taking a small particle and having it obscure in some cases, something that would typically be a lot louder and you would associate with being more powerful, is again quite interesting, and it becomes almost a commentary on the material. And of course, the opportunity to do that is afforded by the degree of malleability that modern software offers you, and also I think an attitude towards what a sound piece can constitute, a musical piece can constitute. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we're not just dealing with music which is trying to reinterpret something that you'd normally hear in a live environment. I mean, that's very interesting in itself, but if I'm working on a computer, then I'm just as interested in how one tiny, seemingly inconsequential sound can actually be more prominent and more distinct than a whole mass of sound that's suddenly beneath it.
So where that comes in is sort of an effect, like in a club tune where the main instruments drop out and you get just the percussion showing itself out. The main themes in here, you've got a couple of them. And if I had to say, you know, what's the melody of the song? It's da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. It's this first sampled guitar thing. Is that something that came first? Because that seems like that's the hook of the song, besides, you know, the waterfall arpeggio thing.
Yes, it did. I mean, this kind of relates quite strongly to one of the ways I work, which... Before I started working on albums like Preparation and Apparatus, my musical output consisted entirely of songs. I wrote songs on a guitar and I sang, and I still do a lot of that. Beginning to work with electronic music was, I mean, I wouldn't say it was liberating, because I still feel a lot of freedom when I write on a guitar and sing, but it opened up a huge number of different avenues. One of them was this idea of not writing a chord sequence and then a melody on the top or something like that. It was actually working on all the different elements almost at the same time. So rather than writing a melody and then stacking harmony on top of it, you actually have a drum beat or something rhythmic, and then something vaguely melodic or harmonic, and then something on top of that. It's this idea of using a kind of block of sound. So rather than building up that sound across a track from beginning to end, you start off with this mass. It's quite sculptural, I think, and then you see where that wants to go. It's a very cumbersome way of working in many ways, because you're not able to sort of progress the piece very easily without sort of losing track of the other elements. But that's pretty much how Circle developed. So the bit that you just sang very well was part of the rest of that massive sound. And sometimes I don't even necessarily know which one of these small parts is going to end up being the melody. I could take something in the bass or the bass drum and say, well, actually, that, for whatever reason, has a texture, or it has something which is making me fixate on it, or I'm finding that's the sort of point of interest. And so I'll take that and I'll develop that as the main point that one follows from beginning to end. So, yeah, this is sometimes a very inefficient way of working, but it leads to very different results. You end up with something that you would never have ended up with if you'd preconceived it in some way.
So then as you go on, you get the second sampled guitar theme, which I won't try to sing, but it sort of sounds like a hyperactive classical guitar. Did that come from the same pot of riffs as the first one?
Yeah. And again, this is emblematic, if you like, of a way I work very typically, which is that I will begin a piece with a certain number of components. So there's quite a sort of inspirational beginning to starting on a piece. And then those sounds that I've collected, they become the massive sounds that I'll work with until the piece is finished. These are the boundaries that I work within, I suppose. And part of that is for pragmatic reasons, because obviously it's very, very easy just to keep adding material to tracks these days. So I find that quite useful. And also, I think it encourages sort of looking further into what one has, and also trying to understand why one made those usually intuitive decisions in the first place to sort of settle on those notes or those chords, or those instruments, those sounds. So all the material in that track, all the sounds rather, were generated probably just in a few hours. And then it sort of took 3 years to untangle those initial impressions and extrapolate them into what one can hear.
So am I remembering correctly, it sounded like at the end of the song that you actually have a few layers of actually played electric guitar to sort of put in a little solo and add some...
Those little runs, they were generated in this initial sessions. So sometimes I'll sort of keep material back that maybe didn't make sense when I was initially bolting the various components together. And then sometimes when there's quite a lot in place and I'm looking for something refreshing and to sort of come on later on in a piece, I'll go back to these initial recordings and go back through them again. And sometimes you find something which is really quite useful. And there is an advantage in using that material because it has a flavor, a redolence of the time. So in a way, it takes you back to that time when you originally started the piece. So although I could obviously play something on top of what I've developed, being able to go back to something that was done in that initial spurt of activity allows me to find something fresh that I haven't maybe thought about in relation to that piece for a long time, but still has hallmarks of the attitude I had when I began.
The way you've described putting this together sounds like a very cerebral, I would almost say purely aesthetic process, in terms of, it's not like when you write lyrics and you're doing a performance of something and kind of how you feel at that moment can affect how the performance comes out. Obviously, that might have been happening when you're developing some of these initial riffs that you're recording, but then going through the many of them and deciding which ones to use, it seems a lot more the sort of quality control and aesthetics part rather than the initial burst of, you know, like a jazz guy would sit down and just do the whole thing. And I know you've done that, plenty of that live playing before. There seems less room in here to say, this is about my mourning for my father or something. Is there any sense of an instrumental like this expressing, well, of course it expresses a mood. It generates a mood. You have this feedback with the sounds as you're putting together, and this is adding to the hypnotic thing, or, you know, well, this is not quite as effective, and so I'll move this over here. But it's a very different picture than expressionism or something.
Yeah, it's a very good point you make. And there are, of course, times when it becomes a very cerebral exercise. And one has to ask oneself whether that sort of degree of pedantry that sometimes is involved in sorting this material is worth it. Is one actually getting away from a sort of more visceral expression? And I have to go back to sort of the answer I gave to your, I think, your first question, which is that there was a value in those initial impressions that I couldn't hope to subsequently reproduce. I felt beholden to those initial ideas, and I felt I needed to do the best I could with them because they were formulated from a unique experience.
Sure.
So for me, it was really a question of just, it would take as long as it takes. But having said that, there are, I think, periods during this sifting process which are surprisingly performance-like in terms of the effect they have on me. Maybe, I mean, it's not something I'd want to invite someone around to witness. But again, because you're dealing with a computer that's playing something back, you have this opportunity to become participatory in a way that you see fit. You can be extremely expressive with external controllers, and there's also a lot of expression that goes into manipulating material that isn't necessarily kept. There may be some small aspect of it. So it really is more of a back and forth process. This block of sound, these various interlinked segments, and then there may be occasions where I'm very, very expressive with that material, and then I'll put it away, and then I'll get it out again when I can be very objective and decide which parts of that exercise are worth holding on to. So although the pieces eventually are obviously highly contrived, there are actually, you know, various phases of their experience before they come to the point where I decide that they should be set in stone, which in itself is a difficult process. But working on a piece can be a sort of oddly exciting process. There are times when the piece can almost be stagnant. It's moving along very, very slowly, just incrementally. And then you come out the other side of it sometimes, and the piece will move very, very quickly. And that can be a very similar experience to the one that has when one suddenly plays a riff on the guitar and thinks, oh, wow, you know, this is going to turn. You suddenly see a path open up and you think, ah, this little riff I'm playing here is going to form the basis for a whole song. And that can happen with electronic sound as well.
Well, you mentioned being able to tweak a riff like the arpeggiated part to change a little bit of it with a very small motion. Am I to understand that in some of these cases you have the loop playing and are able, with the way that you are controlling it, to actually in real time make these edits? Or is it always...
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. I'm very crude in early stages when I do this kind of thing myself. And it's always, okay, stop, zoom in, find out which note you want to tweak, then very slightly, like it's anything but expressive. You know, you can be as anal as you want in terms of tweaking things, but it's never part of the expression in terms of...
I work like that as well. Sometimes you have to stop things and move them in a very workmanlike fashion. But yeah, just as often I will be very expressive in a sense. It's not obviously as gestural as banging an electric guitar or being so obviously gestural, I suppose.
So what is the interface? That is, you have a keyboard hooked up. What are the gestures in particular?
Yeah. I mean, I have a sort of controlling device, so sometimes you're just turning a dial. I have a sort of ribbon type effect that enables me to do different things. I have some sliders. I have some buttons that do different things. And also, I mean, just the guitar itself, of course, becomes a slightly different thing when you're playing against a loop in a situation which is removed from playing on a stage or in a band or with a view of just sort of rendering a song. And even the physicality in regards to the computer is, I think, quite interesting in this respect, because one doesn't necessarily have to be facing the computer all the time. You know, you can be sort of walking around or have your back to it, get away from the whole visual aspect of it, which can be very counterproductive, I think, because I see this all the time in the way particularly students I've had in the past have worked. They become very beholden to what this thing should look like, because the visual side of using music software is so seductive.
Yeah.
Sometimes I become quite aware of that in my own work and make a very concrete decision just to move away from it. The mental picture of the sound that one forms just shifts immediately. You turn around, suddenly you don't have this visual guide. You make different decisions. Things sort of very often fall into place more easily. It becomes easier to see, to hear, to imagine what one should do next. When that doesn't happen, that's why I stop. I don't like sort of forcing work into place. Or sometimes having a very bludgeoning approach can be useful. Normally, if I don't know what to do with something, I'll put it away, and then I'll come back maybe months later and listen to it. And the advantage of working like that is that you forget how much work you may have put into sort of producing one part of the work, and you're able just to be very objective to the point where you can just throw something away that doesn't work. So you lose this sentimental aspect of making the work. You think, well, I want to keep that because I spent so many hours making it. Well, you know, if you come back to it months later and you can hear it doesn't work, it's much easier just to say, okay, we'll lose that. It doesn't function. So attitude towards composition, it's physical and it's gestural, but it's about attitude towards material as well. I want to remove myself a long time ago from this idea that I need to finish something by a certain time. And of course, there are certain things I do which have those restrictions, and particularly when one, that's why I still play live. I think it's extraordinary, and particularly to improvise live is an extraordinary thing to get involved with. You're working in a completely different way with a completely different expectation of how to produce a satisfactory result. But with electronic music, I think one of the beauties of it is to be able to come back and re-experience it and get more into a position that someone listening to it from the first time would have.
All right, we should get to the second song. We've spent a long time, but this was very valuable in terms of establishing how you write. So the second song, Decay, is from the same album. It's the next song on the album, actually. A little bit of a different approach in that it's less guitar focused. It starts off with a more traditional drum machine groove. I could actually see this one being played in a club.
This is a meditation on dying, really. And I think the only way one would understand it to possibly mean that is from the title. The titles are very important on this record. Obviously, there are no lyrics. So the one opportunity one has to gain some insight into the way this music is intended is from the titles.
that has a much stronger central melodic riff. What is that? Is it breath-controlled synth?
You're along the right lines. It's actually a mobile phone, a smartphone, with a kind of flute inside it. So what you're listening to is my own breath coupled together with the sound it produces. So, yeah, I didn't want to just use this synthetic sound coming out of the thing. So I recorded myself playing it using a microphone.
Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense because, I mean, you can hear the consistency in the sound it's producing, but the breath in particular, I was wondering, okay, if that's part of the sound, how much tweaking are you having to do on the breath? And I'm trying to picture you slaving over the breath. No, no, okay, it's just actual breath. That's why it's different.
It's actual breath, yeah. breath obviously has an enormous number of different connotations, and obviously it's necessary for us to stay alive. So this is one aspect of the world one could choose to think about while listening to the track. It's about breath, it's about being alive, it's about what sensation one is producing with breath while one makes this route through life. You wouldn't think it probably, but based on the fact that we're talking about electronic music, but of all the different things I've done musically, and singing is the one I spent most time on. And if I could just do one thing musically for the rest of my life, it would be singing. And of course, breath is intrinsic to that process. So it's something I think about a lot, even when I'm not using it to produce singing. So, I mean, sometimes I'll use a device that may not be of much interest to someone listening, but it will be sufficiently interesting for me in order to drive me through the piece. And I think that's an example of that. To me, it's a driver, if you like. I'm listening to breath. To me, it had a particular significance at the time I chose to record it because I'm thinking of it sustaining life. And that sort of becomes the instigator for sort of producing the rest of the sound around it.
I'm being driven here to want to make like a Kenny G joke that you... this is the closest that you're going to get to the soprano sax. But it was peculiar to me that this was called Decay, and you're saying that it's about death, given that one of the primary things going on here is this little music box riff, and the way that you end the song is with this tinkly synth music box riff getting faster and faster and faster and kind of running off into the distance, which doesn't sound like decay to me. That's something else. It's not the sounds falling apart and getting more chaotic as it's going. It sort of at least belies that cliche of what decay might be.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a very good reason for that. It's because the decay that I witnessed was very atypical. My father was an absolutely extraordinary person. And one of the many extraordinary things he did was his behavior whilst he had cancer. He sort of died very slowly. And he had an extraordinary sort of self-control and grace, which, if anything, was accentuated during that period, which was absolutely astonishing to me and to other people around him as well at the time. So I agree that it doesn't perhaps mirror a typical experience of witnessing decay, but it was my experience. And the tinkling sounds really for me, are a kind of relief on the other side of that decay.
Gotcha. Now, as it's nearing the end, this is where I thought that you added an actual just regular old guitar solo that was not sampled. Is that not right? This is still layered samples?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'll record something and I won't mess with it very much. Sometimes I'll just say, well, that's fine, and make a few small adjustments and that's it. So I'm not beholden to any particular aesthetic in that way. If something fits, then I'll leave it.
All right. So it's just a matter of how granular the samples are, that punching in and playing a 2-measure run, it's not playing the song from beginning to end. It's still a created element that is being slapped in there, but it's different than creating this quarter note by quarter note series of connected samples, which then get put in to make a riff that you didn't actually play, which it sounds like is more what you were doing with the previous song.
Yeah, it's a very collage type exercise, really. I mean, all my work is like that. To me, this is fascinating that you can take one small, tiny sound and produce something symphonic from it, or you can take something which is really quite symphonic and reduce it to something of atom-like proportions. I find that very enjoyable, being able to fit these different elements together and change the perspective that the listener will have on those elements. So, yeah, sometimes I'll construct something from one tiny sound. Other times, it essentially is a field recording, really, that's being integrated.
Well, it seems with the case of both of these, the reason that you can keep layering these things is because you're basically working off of one chord, that the groove, this one even more specifically, I mean, it is a minor chord that's just set right at the beginning, and that you're... So if you add something that is strange in the sound, just as opposed to the beginning and the end of Circle, where you had this 3-chord sequence that seemed like a composed song that's more similar to the third song that we're going to talk about, and then it we've exited the, you know, that was just the warm up. And now we're entered the groove section that just seems like if you said, okay, now the whole thing is going to shift to the fourth chord instead of the first, you know, that would create chaos or have you tried to do that with this kind of a layered approach?
I have, and it's very interesting you should bring that up because it's something that I struggle with a lot, how to shift this whole sort of massive sound into what would be a seven chord or something like that. So logistically, it's quite difficult, but sometimes it's something I deliberately want to avoid, and Decay is a good example of that, actually. I deliberately wanted to keep it repetitive in terms of the chord structure because, to me, there was no way out of this process that the chord sequence and the music as a whole was reflecting for me. I was experiencing or commenting or relating or responding to a process that was not going to deviate in any way. The more general question of moving instrumental electronic music around, I think, is interesting. And it's something I'm thinking a lot about at the moment with new material I'm working on and adjusting my initial approach to composition and perhaps going back to something which is initially more linear, more like writing a piece of song or something symphonic, and then using some of these techniques I've developed to sort of work into that material. Structure is becoming progressively more and more interesting to me. I feel like I have a vocabulary which is useful and methods for rendering it, which are sort of fairly mature. I'm becoming more and more interested in how I can send these different particles, whatever they may be, on different journeys and make the overall structure more and more interesting, rather than just the different sounds and textures.
Well, I did find the structure here interesting in that, so the whole song is about 5 minutes long, and about 2 minutes in, it basically stops. You had played your melody, and it kind of has a little coda at the end of the melody where it repeats its last phrase a couple times, and then dun, 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 like, okay, now the melody is done, and everything drops out except the music box part again, a little rhythm comes in and out, and then you basically are able to start the song over in a certain way. And that continues to go for another 3 minutes. Is it just the inertia of how the fact that that melody was reaching its stopping point, and so you have a breather there. And then when it comes in the second time, you're able to elaborate a little further. And so that, well, okay, so that took 3 minutes to work itself out to the final steam.
Well, I never think in terms of minutes and seconds, but what I do all the time is listen very, very hard to what material seems to want to do. That's the sort of golden rule, really, that I have with all the work I do, regardless of what kind of music it is. It's very much about listening and, to some extent, trying to divorce oneself from an egotistical approach. And obviously, there is an innate egotistical approach to any music that anyone makes, but as far as possible, I'm trying to get away from what I may spontaneously feel like doing and become more beholden to what the work itself seems to want to be. So if I decide it wants to stop at one point, it's because that seems to me to be what this material wants to do. And then in the example you're talking about in Decay, the sounds immediately after that, they're almost a sort of commentary, I think, for me on what's happened before. And then there's a sort of recapitulation on what's happened previously. So although on some levels, obviously, the music is familiar stylistically in terms of how it develops, I'm sort of fully prepared to sort of break out of that at any point if I feel that's appropriate. And it may take 10 minutes of floating around, half an hour, it doesn't matter to me. I'm not interested in sort of adhering to a particular form. I just want whatever happens to be true to what precedes it. Working digitally, being able to work in a highly, highly controlled fashion. I mean, it's something one can play around with. And again, I think it goes back to this word tension, to how long could I stop in that piece and not have anything obviously rhythmic happen before it becomes tiresome for the listener.
That's exactly what I was referring to in saying that writing this way seems like it's almost a more purely aesthetic experience because you're not paying attention to the rhythms of your body and whether it feels like now I should let the note go down. You're paying attention to this thing that is already recorded in front of you and you're just listening and like, where does this seem like it wants to go? No, that's getting a little boring. Let's cut out two measures there. That feels like it needs an extra layer and let's, you know, that it is letting the material speak back to you, which, you know, of course, even if you're doing a traditional rock song, that's what a producer's supposed to do. So this just seems a natural outgrowth of the fact that you are your own producer and your own engineer, and you're not tying your hands. You're not saying, I'm going to just write a song beforehand, and then I'm just going to pretty much sit down and record it, and I don't really know what else to do. And you've mastered the technology enough, and in fact, the technology is an inseparable part of creating the music, such that it moves the flavor of the creativity. It sort of spreads it out over more choices rather than all in the performance initially.
Exactly. And yet again, I think you hit upon something which is very interesting. To me, there is really no distinction between being a composer, a performer, an editor, producer, sound engineer, whatever you want to call it, when you're working on your own with something like a computer. And obviously, a lot of those things could also be said about working with a tape recorder before then. It's just that now you have even more control. All of those different jobs, if you like, they all condition the experience of sound of a piece of work. So I don't really see why they should be considered necessarily as separate entities. Obviously, there's a need for that in various contexts. But if I'm working on my own, then, you know, why shouldn't I spend a day compressing something and another day building a harmony? You know, all of those things.
Patient man.
I think it's just a question of depending on how long something takes. I mean, the first album I made, Preparation, took 6 weeks. Everything happened incredibly quickly, and I was very satisfied with it. It was one of the most magical experiences I've ever had. It was extraordinary. I couldn't believe I'd made something that I really liked.
We should tell folks that the first two albums, Preparation and Apparatus, were released under the name Philosopher's Stone. So folks can find those on Spotify, iTunes. Not to be concerned with a Kentucky band called Philosopher's Stone.
Different entirely.
No, this happens more and more where bands that are geographically, temporally distant get lumped by these streaming services or purchasing services into, it's one band, because no human being actually goes in and says, no, this is Amp the Band number one, this is Amp the Band number two, or whatever. But between those first albums and the current work, the third song we're going to listen to is from your album Spectra, which you said came out in 2012, which is more traditional song structures, singing, playing guitar. I noticed this one is not on iTunes or Spotify. People just have to go to your website to get this.
It's ironic, actually, because when this came out, this was the best distributed album I'd ever released. It was released on a Canadian label called Revolution Harmony. And they actually did an extraordinarily good job in getting that material onto a huge number of different websites, all kinds of different outlets, although there wasn't a physical sort of CD-type release. And unfortunately, that label, it went bust. But yeah, as you say, if you go to my website, there are recordings there. And I intend to have it re-released again at some point.
Well, so this was the way this episode was pitched to me originally was, we just want to promote the new album. And finding out then that you had done things with vocals and traditional song structures, given that that's my background, this was the boon to me to give me something that was a little easier to sink my teeth into.
Well, you've done a great job so far of listening to the electronic music. Thank you for being so attentive to it.
All right, so this is called Sovereign. Do you have any initial introductory words before people hear it?
This is a piece of music, I suppose, where the lyric is very important, and it really is a fairly direct commentary on the idea that one suddenly notices that one's life has sort of been documented in song form, and that one is almost relying on that as a means to reflect, to codify, I suppose, to some extent, what one's been experienced. So there's a sort of journalistic aspect to it. There's a therapeutic aspect to writing and playing. Also, there is obviously the connotation of song in a more general form, providing a foil, providing reflection, providing nutrition almost for one's existence. It is just a series of thoughts about how involving and immersive that process can be and how valuable it can be and the effect that it can have as well. I used to perform songs live an awful lot on a very regular basis, and I still do sometimes. And I still find that an extraordinary experience, partly because of the response that I get, not necessarily positive, but just the fact that one is in a position to immediately affect someone and to discern what kind of effect one has produced, I think is fascinating. So the song is really just a collection of thoughts on all of those things.
Dreams. starting your life and echoing screams. A soaring melody holds the yearnings of the time. Sailing through the sky, a memory of another place, a gentle smile, long lost face, a sentiment that can't be replaced. A pattern lingers in the cinders. Belonging to the past, cast a voice to the unknown. Who knows where it will rest, or where it shall be blown. A law of nature holds that we will be reborn, that the lost shall yet return, like a memory of another place. A gentle smile, long lost face, a sentiment that can't be replaced. A pattern lingers in the cinders, in the cinders. A soaring melody holds the yearning of the time. Sailing through the sky, a memory of another place. Gentle smile, a long lost face, a sentiment that can't be replaced. A pattern lingers in the cinders, in the
Where do we want to start with this? It's a nice minor key tune. It has a chord structure that's interesting, that is discernible. The arrangement is fairly simple, that you've got your acoustic guitar part. Is that a 12-string?
It is indeed, yes.
Yes, okay. A nice, shiny 12-string acoustic guitar part that, and then when your singing comes in, it's even way louder than the 12-string, that it's really intimate, in-your-face singing. But then under this all is the Gareth Mitchell secret sauce, this swooshy, what is it, backward reverb electric guitar. Is that just one guitar, or is that overdubbed? What is this?
I think it was one electric guitar. It wasn't backward. I think it was guitar with some reverb on it. Yeah, I mean, I tried a lot of different reverbs, and obviously if you're working with electronic music a lot, then you build up a pretty good library of different sort of reverb sounds. And
yeah, it was the reverb that I thought was backward, not the part. I know this is
right,
not,
okay.
This is not Revolver. This is not.
I don't think the reverb is backwards. But. So you're interested in the voice being up front or this sort of sound being in the back? I think that, that was a very deliberate decision. I thought the vocal part was strong and I decided that it should be up front. And there was a lot of detail in the vocal that I wanted to be heard. So it was a decision I made to sort of make everything revolve around that. But having said that, it can influence the way a song is perceived by having this secret source, as you describe it, and having these different sounds in the background that perhaps are a little bit unusual in a piece of work that's, as you say, a fairly conventional type of song structurally and in terms of the instrumentation. So, yeah, having these little things in the background that are just sort of making one feel slightly differently about the material, perhaps not initially realizing why. I find that quite interesting, sort of working on this very quiet level. And I like to think quite visually about mixing material. So, yeah, as you say, the vocals are way up front. And to me, there's a background there. There's a landscape. There's something in the background which is kind of percolating, or it's a sunset, or it's something. It's something which is just offsetting the material that's way up front and more easily discernible.
Now, do you remember in putting this together, sort of what were the first elements? Is it like the main riff, the dun 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 dun? Was that something that was a starting point, or that's just something that's built out as it comes after the first verse and just was a natural?
This, I think, develops in a way that you probably yourself can relate to. I was in Germany, actually, when I began that song, and you'll have heard this kind of story a million times. I mean, you're just playing around with a guitar and you come across a riff. And to me, there is a similarity, though, with the electronic work in that I'm always looking for a seed or a kernel or something which is intrinsically interesting, at one chord or the way one chord is played or the way one chord changes to the next, one small little thing. And that for me is a very important process because I'm very sensitive to those moments when they come, which is seldom, but when they come, I think, there it is. There's this one little moment. And this is an example of utilizing that muse, if you like, or that little minor epiphany. Seizing upon one little rhythm, one little kind of little internal motor that chord sequence has and thinking, there's something in there. I would like to investigate this. So you just keep playing it and working the song and playing it again and again, defining exactly where the vocal note should be and how often certain sections should play for. So it's a very traditionally constructed song. It's really in the production, I think, I suppose in the performance as well, but also in the production, I spent a lot of time trying to make it sound as immersive as possible, I suppose. I didn't want the production to sort of get in the way of the performance in the way that your little girl objected to with the piece of music in Apparatus, for which I am profoundly sorry. So this was more along the lines of trying to do justice to a song in the way one would hear it live, but working with some of the potential that recording apparatus affords one.
That underlying electric guitar provides that background landscape, but there are also just on every level, the choice of phrasing, the speed at which you're singing, the thickness of the chords all just point to this open chasm field. I don't know, something, you know, the fact that you've got both flying imagery and ship imagery, but no, it's sailing through the sky. We're just going to put them right together. We're going to make this just to make it maximally dreamlike. I don't know if that's the right word, because it's not like you put a load of phasing on the vocal to make it sound like a 60s psychedelic song. It's not that kind of dreamlike, but just in terms of the soaring melody, trying to show it off as you're saying it, just in terms of the thickness of the chords, like the song is sovereign. It carries all your dreams. When you use thick chords like this, is it a matter of you're just playing around on guitar and this is a finger combination that produces something particularly cool? Or are you thinking in terms of, I'll add a 13th here?
I see what you mean. Okay, so the sort of music theory approach to things, I wasn't really using very much at the time I wrote that. I use it a bit more now, but normally when I'm stuck, I think it's incredibly useful to understand that information. And it wasn't really until I found myself in a position where I was having to teach it, I really got to grips with it, which maybe sounds like it's the wrong way around. And
That entirely makes sense to me. It's just you can stumble across more, especially if you're... So this was normal tuning on the 12 string, right? Or was it...
Yeah, okay. It was. I've played around with a lot of different tunings on guitar. Normally, I imagine you probably play the 12 string and you know how difficult it is to tune them, so...
Yeah, it's not really worth it. You could do a drop D or something, but that's
exactly that. Yeah, I use those quite a lot on a 12 string and tend to leave the more experimental tunings to 6 string acoustic guitar or something. But yeah, I think playing around and being intuitive is great. But there are times, I think, where every musician gets kind of stuck. And when I mean stuck, I mean they know they're stuck. I mean, obviously, anyone can place another chord after another one and say, well, that will do. But almost always one gets to a point in composing where one thinks, well, where should this go next? And I think that's where music theory can be invaluable. It certainly helped me a lot. Having said that, I think when I composed that song, I didn't really need to reach for anything theoretical in order to finish it off. But by that point, I'd been playing guitar long enough to know that I could produce certain effects on certain parts of the guitar that I couldn't on others. So on that song, there's a capo on the guitar, for example. So obviously you're enhancing the already kind of chiming nature of a 12-string guitar by
making it harder to keep in tune properly.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you're tuning the guitar once the capo's on, really, and it's got a working there and nowhere else. And I think that's really interesting when you're working with a voice and I'm sort of singing in a fairly low register on that song. So to use strings which are all quite high, mostly, I suppose. It just creates an interesting juxtaposition. You have the guitar sort of filling out a particular sonic realm and the voice another one. And sometimes I'll go the other way. I mean, recently I've been experimenting with singing, composing just over bass guitar, and that can be quite interesting in terms of how it pushes one and just in terms of the ideas that formulate in one's mind.
Well, and that doesn't obviously tie you as closely to a particular chord, that it's more like the sequencing, that if you're just working with a bass line, then it sort of leaves you a little more open to make the melody twist in a different way than perhaps if you had 5 different tones in your guitar already there constraining you.
Yeah, interesting you should use that word, constrain. I mean, I think to me, guitar has always been a battle. It's a battle I love, and there are times when I adore it, but I'm sort of quite often struck by its limitations as well, particularly in terms of sustain. This is something that frustrates me on quite a regular basis, wanting guitar to have violin or cello-like aspects and capabilities. So I kind of get into using effects pedals and various other implements in order to create that effect. There's a part of me that would quite like to play cello, really, and sing over that.
Well, this is very coincidental. I don't know if you knew Kevin Godley, who was the guy I interviewed for our last interview. He and his partner, Lal Cream, invented in the late 70s. Yes, the Gizmotron.
Gizmotron, yeah.
Which apparently there are like no working copies of existed. It was not a very solid design, and pretty much samplers came along and made it, or synthesizers themselves, and made it not so important. But the idea was just to give a bow to a guitarist. And I thought it was just like the e-bow, but it's not like an e-bow. It's an actual spinning mechanical thing that you lower over the strings and scrubs them really fast. Have you ever played around with violin bows or any of that kind of thing with guitar?
I have a little bit, and screwdrivers and various other implements, you know, that can produce very interesting effects. It's very hard to use those things and get them to produce a sound that one anticipates. You have to certainly I have to direct pretty much my entire concentration on it. It's quite hard to sort of sing while you're doing that because you're not just working within the range of a fret. I mean, the sound will change microtonally depending on exactly where a piece of metal resides, so it requires a lot of concentration. And that's what I'm using on a piece of music I think we're going to introduce this interview with. There's sort of various pieces of metal being introduced onto the strings of the guitar and then looped, which is a fascinating process, and this is one way in which I produce guitar sounds. I mean, not just by simply playing chords, but by addressing the instrument in all manner of different ways in a very sort of music concrete type fashion, you know, banging it, tapping it, stroking it, running other guitar strings over it, all these kind of things. And I particularly like using electric guitars that are turned up very loud, but you address them very quietly. And this is quite fascinating, really, all these different overtones that they can produce.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up in terms of just getting a sustained tone. You know, I listen to Steve Hackett or somebody like that, or even Brian May, although Brian May's guitars are more obviously just a lot of distortion that if you turn the saturation up, it'll have a lot of sustain. I remember going to a music store when I was 17, when I was buying guitar pedals, and asking the guy, like, how could I just get as much sustain as if I was playing a keyboard? And he's like, more distortion than the good Lord allows. That's the way you do that.
Yeah. There are a few products, actually. There's a guy called Keith McMillan, does all kinds of various sort of controller devices. And he's been threatening to release a sort of piece of equipment that allows guitar strings to sustain. It's been on his website for a couple of years, and I keep hoping that he's going to allow it out into the wild. And there's a piece of equipment that I think it's Fernandez guitars make called the Sustainiac, which is another piece of equipment that you can have bolted onto your instrument.
Well, and I guess if you're going to bolt something to your guitar, you have to find the guitar you don't like that much anymore.
Yeah.
Well, we're reaching the end of our time here. Say something about the song that we're going to leave people with. So this is Granulations. You've listed this as unfinished.
Yeah.
Is this your post-72 work, or is this overlapping?
Well, I suppose, yeah, there was a degree of overlapping. I started it before I finished 72, but most of the work I did on it after 72 was finished. So this is a piece that's going to be sung over by the singer from Diggable Planets. And it's part of this idea that Sean Coryell, who runs Eye Contact, he's very interested in having work remixed and reinterpreted. And he's been extraordinary in his efforts to find people who will work with this material I've generated. And up until now, it's been with work that I've done for the 72 album. And this will be the first piece that will have something done to it. It doesn't come from that record. And I've got no idea whatsoever what this lady's going to do to this piece of work, because when I made it, I really didn't imagine it as being something that someone would sing over.
Well, it's definitely got an Indian Eastern flavor, where the bass slash bass drum are serving the same role as a tabla, and it's got this Indian sort of melody. So I, you know, somebody in singing in Hindi doing one of those swooping.
Yeah, this Ladybug Mecca, the way she's going to sing on this, I don't imagine it will be of that nature, but it would be a lovely idea, I think, to have someone singing in Hindi. I grew up in a part of London with a very big Indian community. My oldest friends are Indian, so I've heard quite a lot of Indian music in my life. It's often sort of been in the background. So, yeah, sometimes one wonders where these ideas come from, where they derive from, and yeah, maybe there is something in that, that there is this Indianness that somehow crept into that material. But the piece is another example of pieces of sound that have been joined together, stitched together. I sometimes think in terms of sort of knitting analogies almost, or something quite visual anyway. And this piece was always interesting to me because it utilized a lot of the techniques I used in 72, but it has a completely different spiritual orientation, I suppose one could say. It has a certain joy or a sense of inquiry. It's looking into the world and finding different aspects of the world which are of interest, reflecting that excitement, I think.
Well, folks should look first, I guess, at garethmitchell.info. Just to get a flavor of the kind of places you do concerts that people are thinking, well, who is this played in front of? But I see that there's art galleries. What is your general venue? It's not nightclubs, right?
I have played in nightclubs. I did play a nightclub last year. But I do play in a lot of small places, particularly in Germany, and sort of small clubs in London sometimes where you can experiment with laptops, that kind of thing. And I've played on all kinds of different stages, really, when I think about it. Obviously, if you're playing a song on a guitar, that could be just about anywhere. I do a lot of sound design work at the moment. I work with dancers. In a few months' time, I'll be in Düsseldorf working in the opera house with a really extraordinary sort of choreographer and some amazing dancers, set designer, lighting designer. And that's also a valuable experience, obviously, because you're able to situate your work in relation to other people that are really immersed in what they're doing. And that can be very stimulating.
Well, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you very much for having me on the program. And thank you again for your intent listening.
Well, it's been an enjoyable experience being sucked into your strange, strange world.
Thank you.
Here's Granulations. Thank you.
Okay, folks, thanks for listening. Thanks to Gareth for being a great guest. You know, as much as I'd like to get those British intellectual songwriters that I grew up with, like Peter Gabriel, Brian Eno, Robert Fripp, I seriously doubt whether those guys would have anything to say that is more intelligent, that is more well thought out, that is more helpful than what you just got out of Gareth. Thanks also to Sean Coriel at Eye Contact Maui, who's the one who hooked me up with Gareth, and his label will be releasing the 72 album, it looks like March 31st. However, if you go to nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or its parent site, partiallyexaminedlife.com, and sign up for that $5 recurring donation, or really, you could just pay one time and then unsubscribe. If you sign up for that, among the many bonus audio products, you will find a post that will link you to the whole album that you can listen to now before it's released. Also there, you will soon find something like an additional half hour of discussion that I had with Gareth after this interview took place. We talk about the economics of music and some other stuff. So I'm going to try to make a habit of posting that kind of bonus audio extra discussion behind our firewall to reward those who will commit to a recurring donation. As you've heard, there are no commercials on these, not yet anyway. They do take quite a bit of prep time. So if you want this to continue, I encourage you to go to our website and make some kind of donation or buy something from the store or whatever. I'm very excited on our next episode that I got to talk to Jeff Highschool from Judy Batts. And a couple days ago, I got to interview Tim Quirk, who is in Too Much Joy, now has a project called Wonderlick, and also has been a big executive at Google Play and Rhapsody. So he's a digital music mogul. Now, the thing that would most help out this podcast right now, doesn't cost you anything. If you use iTunes, go to our iTunes store page, leave a nice 5-star rating or review, which will help expose other listeners to this podcast. And of course, you can do that directly by sharing a link to our homepage, nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, or to this episode on your favorite social media outlets. And I will leave you with the same bit of music that we started with, which is called Sweep the Scalded Terrain, Scattering Seeds, from Gareth's Live in Hamburg. You can download that entire track and bits from most of his other albums at garethmitchell.info. All right, again, this is Mark Lintzenmeyer. My musician name is Mark Lint. You can find out more about my work at marklint.com. Happy active listening, and until next time.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in business into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.